When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Murder Mile, a true crime podcast, an audio-guided walk featuring many of London's untold, unsolved, and long-forgotten murders, all set within and beyond the West End. Today's episode is about Annie Sutton, a lone single mother who lived alone in a shared lodging with a series of strangers. All were friendly and liked her, except one who loved her a little too much. But how would she cope living with her own stalker? Murder Mile is researched using authentic sources. It contains moments of satire, shock, and grisly details. And as a dramatization of the real events, it may also feature loud and realistic sounds. So that, no matter where you listen to this podcast, you'll feel like you're actually there. My name is Michael, I am your tour guide, and this is Murder Mile. Episode 141, Annie Sutton and the Stalker Within. Today, I'm standing in Brown Hart Gardens in Mayfair, W1, 1 Street East of the electroconvulsive abortion of Elsie Goldsmith, 3 streets north of the radioactive poisoning of Alexander Litvinenko, 1 street south of the Europa Hotel, where the flight crew of LL016 were massacred, and 4 streets northeast of the last brave fight of Tudor Simonov. Coming soon to Murder Mile. Originally called the Duke Street Gardens, Brown Hart Gardens is one of those architectural anomalies that the average pedestrian walks by every day, knowing it looks out of place, but never asking why. Surrounded on all sides by mansion blocks, the posh word for flats, Brown Hart Gardens is an oblong-shaped walled garden with very ornate features, like a Baroque dome pavilion of Portland stone, paved Italian greenery, and a quaint little cafe. But what it's hiding is a large electricity substation. And that epitomizes Mayfair. Rich and poor, arty and ugly. Two opposites living side by side, with one on show for the world and the other hidden in shame. Here you will see red-trousered numpties standing next to a shambling mess in filthy rags. A snoot of hoity-toities living at large, as life's forgotten few hunker in flappy boxes. And arseholes who begin every sentence with the word I, quaffing fizzy wine which costs an annual salary per bottle, next to a homeless man heated only by a damp sleeping bag and a hit of skag. It has pretty much been erased, but 150 years ago, this part of Mayfair was a place of abject poverty. Comprising of Brown Street and Hart Street, this used to be a series of working-class dwellings for the city's poorest, before its demolition in 1888. Situated at 19 Hart Street was a four-story lodging full of 30 people, with many so broke they were forced to share a room and even a bed with strangers. Living hand to mouth, they could never choose their neighbours. So many simply made the best of it. Some found new pals, but others were left living side by side with someone who would do them harm. As it was here, on Thursday the 20th of January 1887, that Annie Sutton would last interact with her fellow lodger, Joseph King. A stalker who lived for her touch, but loved her to death.
I love Annie. I'm very fond of her. But if I don't have her, no one else shall.
Annie Sutton was typical of many working-class women living in London in the late 1800s. With a cruel, unjust society burdening her with little more than a limited education and few basic skills, she was reliant on others simply to live and was doomed to a sad, relentless existence of poverty and failure. Born in a small village near Exeter in 1847, Annie did everything right according to the rules of the day. As with women banned from keeping savings or owning a home, she was married to ensure her survival. Life was hard, but she made do with what little she had. In August 1885, at the St. George's Parish Workhouse in Mount Street, Annie gave birth to a baby boy called Henry, a small pale sprat named after her husband. Together, this little family of three lived an existence with no certainties. They shared a small cramped room with another family, scraped by on an unsustainable pittance, struggled to pay the week's rent or risk eviction, and ate a meagre ration only if and when they worked. And although the chance of little Henry living into adulthood was slim, with a hard-working labourer father and a devoted mother, his odds were better than 50-50. But as cruel as life was for a working-class woman, fate would be even crueler. In the bitter winter of 1885, Annie's husband died. Left bereft and heartbroken, this 40-year-old recent widow and newly single mother was bequeathed nothing but his last wage. A paltry sum, part of which went to pay for his funeral. With no savings, no policies, no pension, no goods of any value, no family to fall back on, and no benefits doled out by the welfare state to provide a small but vital safety net. Once those 27 shillings were spent, she was out. Annie had two choices: cry or fight. To put a roof over her head, food in her belly, and to stop her one-year-old son being sent to the workhouse, like hundreds of other women within a single square mile, she became a washerwoman, scrubbing the soiled, filthy clothes of strangers for pennies. Of course, she could always remarry, but still being in the grip of grief, love had long escaped her heart. By July 1886, Annie and baby Henry had moved to 19 Hart Street in Mayfair, a series of 4- and 5-storey lodgings which were surrounded by the Duke Street Gardens. Number 19 was a simple brown brick block comprised of 8 small rooms on 4 thin floors, with a basement washroom for bathing and laundry, and being in an era before the luxury of Plumpton gas, water or electricity, it was heated and lit by fires. But it wasn't an unpleasant place to live. On the ground floor lived the landlady Harriet Pearson, an elderly widow who kept a good house for nice people who looked out for one another. And lacking any communal areas except for the stairwell, she would welcome lodgers into her kitchen to cook and to share a meal. The top two floors were housed by four families. But as was standard in any lodging house, the other rooms were occupied by singletons. In the front first floor room, Harriet's adoptive son, William Jewell, shared with a burly omnibus driver called Charles Stansfield. Behind them, in a small back room, two domestic servants, Lizzie Cotton and Emily Sharp, shared a tatty horsehair mattress, as beside them, Annie and her baby slept in a small lumpy bed. And in a back room behind Harriet's kitchen, a slightly deaf elderly servant called Richard Bartholomew shared with a 41-year-old labourer called Joseph King. It was an odd mix of strangers, but everyone seemed friendly. Only Joseph wanted Annie to be more than his friend.
I will have her as my wife. If not, I will break her neck.
The history of Joseph King is a bit of a mystery. Born in Thurston, a Suffolk parish near Bury St. Edmunds in 1846, he was the eldest of two brothers, but since his teenage years, he had no further contact with his parents. Being a thinly built man, with a tangled mess of brown hair like an abandoned rat's nest, sunken yellow eyes like two discarded pots of piss, and a stick-like body punctuated with a beer-filled potbelly. Although Annie would have lived a better life as a wife than as a spinster, he wasn't her type. With hands scuffed, his head scarred, moods which swung from ominously distant to uncomfortably close, and having fallen from a horse aged 17, his tongue rasped with a croaky lisp, his leg dragged and limped, his face unevenly drooped, and the right-hand side of his skull was soft to the touch. According to those who knew him, he wasn't a bad man. He was odd, but no real bother. Burdened by a partial paralysis down the right-hand side of his body, he still earned a modest 27 shillings a week as a bricklayer. He moved to 19 Hart Street 6 months earlier and always paid his 3 shillings a week rent on time. And cheekily, if a little creepily, he referred to his elderly half-deaf bunkmate as Daddy.
Daddy.
During his first month, she rarely saw him, as while she slaved away over hot piles of laundry, he lived up top. But when a cheaper bed became available on the ground floor, suddenly, as she would descend the stairs, she began to sense a creaking and a silence, as a sallow set of hollow eyes closely eyed her. As the weeks passed, all too often, Annie found the uncomfortably tight stairwell conveniently blocked by Joseph, who greeted her with a raspy,
"Oh, good day," again.
And yet he seemed to be going nowhere for no reason. Each time, she was polite, but she never stopped to talk, as the useful excuse of armfuls of unwashed clothes or a screaming baby at her breast always seemed to hasten her step. And as the weeks turned into months, his escalating attention turned from small talk to little gifts. Often he'd give her bread, milk, a brooch, baby shoes, or money to help her get by. Being broke, struggling to save 3 shillings a week for the week's rent, and to keep the workhouse at bay, she knew she shouldn't say yes, so often she didn't. But being a singleton with a hungry child, sometimes no was impossible to say. On Saturday, the 5th of January, 1887, just 2 weeks before her death, Joseph knocked on Annie's door. Opening it a crack, he couldn't see his beloved, hidden by a mountain of sodden clothes and thick steamy clouds which rose from her scorching iron. So Emily Sharp relayed their words.
I've come for my washing.
He said he's come here for his washing. It's not ready. Go back down. She said it's not ready. Go back down.
But before the door was even shut, Joseph was in. Inside her room, he grinned at Annie. But being too busy, Annie ignored him. Emily asked him to leave, as the landlady didn't approve of any men in a lady's room. But Joseph didn't hear her, as his focus was firmly fixed on Annie, her head down and shrouded in mist. At his feet, he saw 18-month-old Henry playing on the wooden floor. Scooping the little tot up, Joseph gently stroked his head with a palsied hand, as on his forehead, he planted a kiss with his wonky lips, muttering,
"Love him. Love this boy."
His love seemed genuine, like he was destined to become his daddy. A little weirded out, Emily snatched the boy back and shoved Joseph out. But before this oddball could be ousted, he said these words.
"I love Annie Sutton. I'm very fond of her."
10 words which Annie ignored, only to then utter,
"But if I don't have her, no one else shall."
Annie Sutton was trapped in her own home with her own stalker. But as being in love isn't a crime, all she could do was keep a distance. Joseph was not shy about airing his deepest feelings of love amongst the lodgers.
"He'd talk about her most nights.
He loved her, he said.
The boy too.
He treated it as if he was the father.
He said he wanted to marry her on Whitsuntide."
But there is always a very fine line between lovesick, besotted, and obsessed. On Saturday the 15th of January, just 6 days before, Joseph was sacked from his job.
"I discharged him, as he was very inefficient and a clumsy workman," said the foreman.
Later adding in court,
"He used to do everything wrong. He was a bit of a loony, a general butt of the jokes. He was not right in the head."
With no job to do and nothing to fill his time, Joseph drank and festered. No matter where Annie went, he was there, watching intently as she went about her life. As she cooked, she washed, she walked, and she slept. Seeing who she talked to, who she ate with, what she said and what she did. He followed her to the shops, to the church, and even to the bathhouse. On Sunday the 16th, between 5 and 6 p.m., a former lodger and frequent customer called Mr. Rolfe came calling at Annie's door. As always, he knocked. She greeted him.
"Hello, Mr. Rolfe. Here you go."
She handed him a bundle of clean clothes. He paid his money and left. To Annie, it meant nothing. As it did to everyone else who lodged at 19 Hart Street. Except one. 10 minutes after Mr. Rolfe had left, Joseph was still seething. As she sat in her room, softly soothing her son to sleep, Annie's ears rumbled to a heavy stamping on the stairs and a hard banging on her door.
Annie! Annie!
Without thinking, she opened it, fearing an accident or a fire. But what she saw was a tearful Joseph fuming with jealousy as a long dribble of drool spilled down his droopy lip.
You have been on the floor with that man, Rolfe.
Believing that in the brief window between being handed his laundry and saying goodbye, that the couple had sex.
You are my sweetheart,
he cried.
I put on my coat and my tobacco and pipes in my pocket, ready to be locked up for you.
Like this was to be the last stand of a desperate man. Of what, we don't know. But with slow, deliberate words, he expressed his undying love for her and rasped,
I would go up to my knees in blood for you.
But whose blood? Having witnessed his strange declaration of adoration, the landlady ushered Joseph back down the thin stairwell, and calmly he returned to his room. He was agitated and emotional, but perfectly sober. 1 hour later, he asked Annie if she could wash his shirts, as if nothing had happened. 2 hours later, he softly knocked on her door and romantically cooed,
Good night, my darling. I'm going out.
But wisely, she had bolted the door shut. Annie didn't have any other option. In the eyes of the law, he hadn't done anything criminal. He was simply a lovesick fool, talking silly. In the eyes of the doctors, he wasn't mad, so nothing could be done. But inside of his obsessive little mind, Joseph believed that he and Annie were already lovers. On the evening of Wednesday the 19th of January 1887, just one night before, Joseph lay in his bed. He was calm, sober, and slept soundly. Beside him, Richard was restless, as somehow he had misplaced his razor. He would later confirm that Joseph hadn't left their room at all that night. Likewise, in the room above, Emily bolted the door shut, and with baby Henry exhausted from a cold, the four occupants slept well, right through to the morning. Only Joseph would deny this.
The woman was in the habit of coming to my room, or I to hers, often two or three times a week, for two or three hours at a time. The landlady disliked fraternization. So it was our little secret.
An affair so secret that no one heard a single thing. Not a bolt and lock, a creaky step, a baby cry, or the moan of its mother in sexual ecstasy. The night was silent. And although Richard may have been half deaf, he wasn't blind. So the last sounds he heard before Joseph snored was him saying,
Good night, Daddy.
The morning of Thursday the 20th of January 1887 was bitter. As a cold biting wind pierced the icy streets of Mayfair. At a little after 8:15 a.m., With her baby still fast asleep in her bed, Annie smoothly unbolted the door, crept down the creaking stairs, and so as not to disturb the snoozing lodgers, she left the silence of the house to pick up a jug of milk and a loaf of bread from a grocer's cart on Duke Street. Oddly, it was there and then, after 5 days of swigging and sloth, that Joseph decided that he needed a job. He shot out of bed, popped on a shirt, his greatcoat and a wide-brimmed hat called a wideawake, and with drive and vigour, he left the room, stating,
"I'm going out for a little while, Daddy."
But in truth, he wouldn't visit any building sites that morning, as he would only walk as far as Duke Street. At 8:50 a.m., Annie returned. Her cheeks were flushed red from a foul wind, but the simple pleasure of freshly baked bread warmed her body, as a cool jug of milk soothed her heat-blistered hands. That day would be like any other. A baby to feed, a few shillings to earn, and a mountain of clothes to wash. Entering the hallway, it was as quiet as when she had left. No one had stirred. And mercifully, her baby was silent as she softly ascended the stairs. But what happened next was heard but not seen. Annie barked three phrases.
"Get off the stairs! Let me pass! Keep your hands off me!"
Abruptly, a milk jug smashed, as a blood-curdling scream ripped through all four floors of the lodging house. Bleary-eyed and half-dressed, the lodgers peered out into the thin dark stairwell. All they saw was Annie and Joseph. Him with a bloody razor gripped in his tight fist, and her with the pale flesh of her neck ripped apart and spewing meat like a burst sausage as a crimson river flowed down her chest. Clutching her silenced throat, which bubbled as she breathed, stumbling down each step and bouncing off each wall to escape the maniac above, Annie staggered into the safety of the landlady's kitchen. Surrounded by friends, here she was safe. As lodgers locked the door, stemmed the flow of blood with a towel, and gave her a brandy to steady her nerves. Only Joseph didn't follow her. He had hurt her just as he had intended. A long, slow slit to stem her words. But upon this woman who had betrayed his love, he would inflict a real pain. The kind she had never felt before and would never feel again. Joseph ran upstairs. He broke open the back room door and with the bloodied razor balled up tight in his fist, as her little child slept sweetly, he began sawing at its neck with the sharp blade, slicing deeper and faster. And unable to cry, with its windpipe severed, as veins split and arteries spewed, he slit the little child's throat, all the way down to its tiny spine. So that by the time the razor was wrestled out of his hand, baby Henry's little head was almost cut clean off. The trial was held on the 28th of January 1887 at the Old Bailey to debate if Joseph King was insane. A doctor declared that he was of low intellect but fit to stand trial. And yet his defense drew attention to his actions, an old scar on his forehead, and the softness to his skull, having fallen from a horse in his teenage years. Upon his arrest, Joseph was taken to the Marlborough Street police station, where he confessed.
I have killed the woman who I love, also her dear child.
Whilst he calmly sat and smoked his pipe. He also claimed they had sex that night, had quarrelled later, and that she had jilted him, but said that the child's murder was her idea. Whilst awaiting his committal hearing, Joseph was given a simple meal of potatoes, meat and bread, which he apparently ate with great lividity, cutting and ripping at his food with his blood-stained hands, often remarking on how the blood remained.
Yes, there it is. It's still there.
As he licked his fingers clean and flatly refused to use a towel or soap.
I won't have them washed. These were the hands that did it.
On the 21st of March, 1887, Joseph King was executed at Newgate Prison. Having been attacked, Annie Sutton bravely fought back her tears and her pain. As this recent widow, a newly grieving mother, was taken to the St. George's Hospital. For 3 days, doctors battled to save her life. But having lost too much blood, and all hope of ever finding happiness again, she died at 1 a.m. and was buried with her baby. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. As always, a non-compulsory chin wag over a tea and a cake follows after the break, where you can learn a few extra details about this case. But feel free to switch off now if you don't like waffle. A big thank you to my new Patreon supporters, who are Bridget Cooper, Alexis Kilday, Amanda Lamb, and Anna Bellingham. I thank you all. Your physical goodies should be with you now, and I hope you've enjoyed the exclusive goodies online.
Whoa!
Plus a thank you to Nicola Smith for sending me a very kind parcel of chocolatey treats in the post, which actually lasted a whole 3 days.
I know! Miracle!
Murder Mile was researched, written and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult With No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard. But thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/acast. That's 15% off at burrow.com/acast.
Oh, what day is it? Oh, that was too long. Oh, Michael, what have you done? Hopefully you've enjoyed that, and hopefully you've gone, that was a fun episode, I enjoyed that, and it's taken you half an hour, and you've gone, fucking hell, it was a nightmare. I mean, it was fun to write, I enjoyed writing it, but, jeez, I overwrote it. Sometimes there's things in there that are really impossible for someone like me, with a bit of a stutter, to really try and get my mouth around. It was a real nightmare. Oh, and even worse. Oh, so I got up, because I'm not too far from, I'm literally next door to a golf course. I'm in a nice quiet place. It's really quiet here. So I thought I'll get up really nice and early before all the idiots go off to play golf and go, oh, I'm going to pretend that I'm doing some business, but really I'm just going to chat to my mates and have some drinks. So I got up really early to beat them, because there's a roadway near me as well, and they're Porsches, and they're Porsches that look like Land Rovers. They're horrible, they are. They really are. They're there, and I thought before they turn up and make some noise. So I got up really freaking early this morning, and the gardener had already been out yesterday mowing the lawns and all that. He's out freaking this morning as well. Freaking this morning. How much can grass grow in a day, you bellend? All because some twats just want to hit balls and anyway. So I recorded most of this, and then I had to re-record most of this, and then the bellend kept coming back, going with a slow hum in the background, and then his mate with the strimmer, prick. Oh, so it's taken ages. This has taken a long time to do this. This really has. So I'm going to open some windows and put on some coffee. Ow, my legs hurt. Oh. It's annoying, listen. Not a freaking sound. Oh, anyway, water on. I'm going to need a coffee. I'm up super early because I'm off into town late. Oh, where's my coffee cup? Why am I asking you? You don't know where my coffee cup is. It's there. It's a Murder Mile mug as well, which is ironic because later on I'm going into town to pick up some more mugs. Whoa, excitement. Hang on. Let me do my... I've got to get into my sugar pot, which is a bugger to get into. You bastard. Open. Oh, I'm going to need some sugar. I shouldn't really be on sugar because I'm on a diet. Yes, I'm on a diet. Some people get fat easily, and I am one of them. So that's good. I'm going to open up the curtains. I'm going to get rid of my... sound protection behind me, which is basically just pillows over the window, which still didn't help get rid of the sound of the bell end with his mower. Ooh, look! Ooh. Egyptian geese. They're lovely. They look very nice. Right, okay. Let's do some stuff. What else is going on? I haven't really got a cake of the week. Oh, I haven't really got any cake because I'm on a diet. I'm trying not to eat carbs. I have a cake once a week now. God, that was a long edit. I was just looking at it. So what I do is I film it every week. So on Patreon now, I have a thing called Cake of the Week, and you can go on there and you can support the podcast, but also you get a nice little video of the Cake of the Week. So I do a little commentary on a cake, and then we do a close-up cut into it, which people seem to love, which is good. That episode was good fun. I enjoyed writing it. It was really quick to write. I really enjoyed it. I had some fun with the wording as well, so I hope you did as well. I thought it made a nice story. That was good. What else is going on? I'm just doing this so as you know, because my kettle's brewing. Oh, I need a wee now, but I don't think we're at that point in the episode where I can kind of wee whilst recording, so I won't do that. Next Monday, which will be the Monday after you hear this, I'm prepping because I am meeting up with Police Constable Arsenal Guinness in the Metropolitan Plod. And we are finally sitting down to record New Blue, which will be very exciting. So that's going to be a three-part series about being a copper. So it's what I'm doing is it's not going to be, tell me some stories about kicking down doors and going, chummy. Do you know all the shit that you see on telly? What I want is to learn about what it's really like to be a copper. Do you know, even the stuff on the alleged inverted commas documentaries that you watch, it's not. That's kind of the more exciting bits, because they know that you won't want to watch something which is just, you know, a policeman sitting down and having to do a shit ton of paperwork. Which is what a lot of it will be. So what I want to do is kind of know more about what it's like to be a copper. So that'll be a three-part series. Prepping the questions for that, we'll have a bit of a giggle. That'll be good. What else is going on? I've moved the boat again because we have to. I'm in a nice place out in the country, as mentioned, next to a golf course where some prick comes by and shaves off an extra millimetre of grass every 6 seconds. But yesterday I decided to turn the boat because my window's on the other side, and I didn't want a window on the towpath side, I wanted it on the other side. So I decided to turn the boat around, and then I got stuck in the mud. A guy went past, he saw me turning it, and he was like, "Are you okay? Are you stuck?" I was like, no, just turning it, mate. 10 seconds after I said, "No, I'm fine," I got stuck. Luckily, my neighbour came out, and it was a nice chance to chat to my neighbour. I tried to throw him my rope. He couldn't reach it because the rope wasn't long enough. Hang on, I'm just going to get my... is that... Oh, God, I shouldn't have stood up. That wee-wee needs to come out. Oh... Yuck. Ah, oh, hot. Hot, as you'd expect from hot water. Hot. Ouch. So that's good. Yeah, no, I threw him my... The weird thing was, I just wanted to flip the boat around, so I took off the ropes and left them on the bank, which was stupid, because you flip the boat around and the ropes are the wrong way. But I hadn't really thought of that. I was having one of those moments. And I left them on the bank, and then the boat started drifting away, and then it ran into a sandbank, and I couldn't get out of the sandbank. So I had to get my new neighbour to throw the ropes to me from the land onto the boat, and the boat was too far away by about five feet, and it was really annoying. We couldn't do it, and then eventually, because I was leaning on one side of the boat drifted, and then I was able to get free. God, that was an exciting story, wasn't it? Hopefully one day they will make a movie about it. You never know. What else is going on? I'm the reason why I'm up early this morning. Oh, that wee is on its way. Is because I'm off into town. I've ordered loads of new mugs. So there is some Reg Christie mugs, some Police Constable Arsenal Guinness mugs, some Blackout Ripper mugs. So they will be available soon. As always, as mentioned, they will be available on Patreon first. So everyone on Patreon the Patreon subscribers get first dibs. Sorry, but that's one of the benefits of being a Patreon subscriber, is you get first dibs and you get lots of exclusive goodies. So it's worth it for like $3 a month, which is £2 in real money. You get a lot of goodies for your £2. You really do. But also you get a lot of exclusive stuff that doesn't make it anywhere else. So, quick slurp of coffee. You can just probably hear Bellend in the background. He hasn't got his mower out now. He's got a strimmer. Bellend. I know he's just doing his job, but Bellend. Right, let's do the quiz questions. Don't forget, as always, I might probably edit some of these out. This was a slightly longer than I would have wanted episode, or I might balls them up as we go into the next bit. So let's do this. Question number one. Joseph did what as a job? Question two. What was the two last things that Annie purchased on Duke Street? Question three. What was the name of Joseph's ex-wife? Question four. What is underneath Brown Heart Gardens? Question five. Which mass murder is nearest to Brown Heart Gardens? Question six. What did Richard Bartholomew, who was Joseph's roommate, do as a job? Question 7. What type of hat did Joseph wear? Question 8. What nickname did Joseph give his roommate, Richard? Question 9. These are some difficult questions, Michael. Question 9. What street was the public bathhouse on that Annie went to? And question 10. What year was 19 Hart Street and most of Hart Street demolished? Right. Let's do this. So let's go into some extra stuff. So I'm going to dive straight into the stuff at the end of the story. So where the attack basically happens. As mentioned, Annie had gone out. Joseph had said that he'd kind of gone looking for jobs. He'd been out for 20 minutes. There was no way he'd gone down to a building site. When he spoke to the officers afterwards, he couldn't mention anywhere that he'd been, so he'd clearly just been stalking Annie and then, you know, seen her going to get two things that I won't mention on Duke Street. See, I'm getting good at this. So what else? As mentioned, he got a razor and he'd slit her throat. It was quite a deep cut. It's amazing that she lasted 3 days. As long as she had, she'd lost a lot of blood. She was unable to speak. But she did last that long. But apparently, according to the autopsy, it was a very, very, very deep wound indeed. So it's amazing she lasted that long. As mentioned, he forced her way into her room. Her flatmate, Emily Sharp, was in there. She said she jumped out of bed. When she heard the sound of Joseph coming up the stairs, I went to put this in the story, but it slowed down the story. She heard him coming up the stairs. She went to try and block the door. He pushed it all his might against it and pushed past her with the razor in hand and went straight to where the baby was. Didn't even look at her, just went straight to the baby. This was while pretty much everyone, all the other lodgers were kind of their heads out the room. Some of them, including Harriet Pearson, the landlady, were downstairs in the kitchen looking after Annie. They obviously were trying to stem the flow of blood around her neck, because obviously you can appreciate at that point that's what they're focused on, was the fact that Annie had been attacked. They didn't know what was going to happen next. Emily said that Joseph rushed in and went straight to the bed where the little child was asleep. There were two beds in the room, as mentioned, a larger one and a smaller one. Annie and her baby slept in the smaller one. She said to him, "What on earth are you going to do?" As she rushed out for the out of the room to get help, and she said as she rushed out, she saw him doing something to the baby's head and neck. As she was running out, she called for Mr. Stanfield, Charles Stanfield, who was. I can't remember if this was a question, so I won't mention that, what he did as a job. I don't think I did that. So he was currently downstairs. He was heading up that way. She ran out into the street and was calling for an officer as well. Charles Stanfield ran up to the room on the first floor, which was Annie's room. He rushed in. He saw that the prisoner was doing something to the child's head. And neck. He grabbed hold of him. They had a fight in the middle of the room. I was going to put this in the story, but again, do you know, sometimes when you're focusing on Annie and her child, sometimes it's better not to put in, even though some things can be quite interesting and exciting, it's worth not putting them in, because it just takes your attention away from the important thing, which is Annie and her child. That's what we're focused on here. So yeah, Charles Stanfield had a fight with Joseph. Joseph still had the razor in his hand. He was fighting and kicking and swinging the razor around, saying, "You bastard, I will treat you the same." Or, "You bastard, I will treat you the same." I enjoyed doing his voice. Hopefully he will come back and I can do his voice again. I decided it was... I was trying to work out what the voice would be in advance, and I decided it would be Basil Rathbone with having had a stroke. I thought that would be a nice way to kind of put across his deformities. So yeah, they had a fight. He almost lost the top of his finger in the fight. That was Charles Stansfield. Mrs. Pearson's son, William Jewell, was trying to help as well, but he was overcome. He was only a little lad, and also he suffered from rheumatics of the hand, so he wasn't able to do much. But quite a few of them, including Charles and William Jewell, were able to subdue the prisoner, as they say, which is Joseph, and they took him downstairs and held him in one of the rooms until the police came up. They were saying that someone was in there shouting, "King is killing the child." Someone shouted, come and take this man away." I'm amazed that someone didn't go, "Murder," as they always seem to do in these stories. What else was there? And the weapon fell to the ground. Don't forget, this is the razor which belonged to Richard, his flatmate. Apparently, Richard said that the razor was on his wash basin the night before, but then it went missing, which is why he spent the night trying to wonder where it had gone. Where it had gone, Joseph had stolen it. So obviously this is a kind of a bit of a form of premeditation there. Police turned up, they went straight to the kitchen. Annie was there. She got a towel on her neck. They were trying to stem the blood as much as possible. First policeman on the scene was Francis Pierce of C Division, police number 309. He said he arrived at about 9:15. He went to the back room on the ground floor. In the back room, which was his room, behind the kitchen, he saw the prisoner sitting down in a chair. Prisoner said, "That's Joseph. I got burpees." He said, he didn't say, "I've got burpees," because that would be a weird thing to say. Although I wouldn't put it past him. He said, "I have killed the woman who I loved, also her dear child." They sent for a doctor at that point, as Annie was still alive and still bleeding. Four men at that point were currently looking after the prisoner, making sure he didn't escape or anything like that. The policeman went up to the room, and when they got there, the child was already dead, as you can appreciate. His throat was cut. Basically, as mentioned, Joseph was sawing at the throat, and it was cut almost right there. It was cut down to the bone, down to the spine. So, you know, the death of the young child was pretty much instantaneous, or as near as. Joseph was taken to Marlborough Street Police Station, which is in Soho. It's just it's not by the Palace Theatre, I can't remember. It's just off Oxford Street, between Oxford Street and Regent Street. Inspector saw him then and he made a statement. He was seen by two doctors, two police surgeons. And he made a full statement. Joseph said, "I am very fond of the boy. I love Sutton." Sutton is what he called Annie. "But she jilted me. And if I don't have her, I will do for her. I will kill her." What else have we got? Yep. Baby is dead, as already mentioned. This was when he was being questioned by the police. The police were asking him what was going on. He said that he and Annie had been, obviously, as mentioned, had been sexual lovers for many weeks, that she would often visit him down in his room, which Richard would deny, because even though Richard was deaf, and that was part of Joseph's alibi, he would say, well, Richard was deaf, so he didn't hear us having sex in the room or hear me leaving. But, of course, Richard wasn't blind. You know, so he could, you know, they're in small rooms. You're going to spot someone having sex next to you. But Joseph said that the Thursday before, him and Annie had had a massive argument. And this is what this was about. It got to the point where they were arguing. It was said to be over something as little as 5 shillings, although we really don't know what these 5 shillings are for, or even what it was really about. When Annie came into the house that morning and Joseph met her on the stairs. He said that they'd still been arguing about the argument from the night before, which no one had actually heard. He wanted to make up with her, but she wouldn't make up with him. He said he kissed her and said, "Well, then, my dear, I must put an end to you." He said that he was very fond of her and her child, and said that, and she said that she, he said that she requested, if he ever did anything to her, that he would also kill her child and not leave the child to the mercy of the world, which is clearly bollocks, clearly utter bollocks. Police turned up. It was easy to identify the weapon. It was the razor that everyone had seen, which was owned by Richard and was on the floor covered in, as mentioned, 2 different types of blood. Obviously, at this point, they can only identify it as just blood. The police inspector was James Bennett. He arrived 9:15, so not too long afterwards. He came into the back parlour and saw Joseph sitting down at the fire, smoking a pipe calmly. Joseph said, "I have committed 2 murders this morning, Inspector. It is a very serious matter. I lived with this woman and slept with her in the bed last night, which he didn't do, pointing to the smallest of two beds in the room, which was his. We had a quarrel this morning. It was about 5 shillings. I cut her throat and the child's also. I felt very strong and felt as if I could commit a lot more murders. 3 men came to me. One was a big fellow, which is Charles, but I knocked him off. He's full of shit, isn't he? Joseph was also examined by a doctor, Frederick William Spurgeon, and he was seen at a little after 9 o'clock, so not too long afterwards. The police surgeon was called to come to the premises. He felt his pulse, he looked at his tongue, which was the thing that doctors did in that era. He said he did not see any indications of delirium tremens, suggesting that everyone had said that Joseph was sober, and they were trying to query whether he was maybe an alcoholic and was going through kind of withdrawals. They couldn't find any of that. Joseph again said, "I have been keeping company with Mrs. Sutton. She drank with me and I gave her money, but she treated me very cruelly and turned me up. As in, she betrayed me. A week ago, I told her I would cut her throat, and she said again, if you do so, kill the child, don't leave it to the mercy of the world, and I have done so." Again, this is bollocks. What else we got? He went through 2 doctors when it went to, before going to trial, because obviously they needed to check whether he was sane or not. They couldn't find any diseases of the mind, they said. They said they did admit that the borderline between sanity and insanity is very narrow. They did see injuries to his head. They were unsure whether it was kind of a sudden mental shock, excessive fatigue, or maybe it was drunkenness that caused him to do what it was, or maybe he was just mental. John Robert Kemp was the divisional surgeon for C Division of the police. He was called that morning and he arrived about an hour later at 9:45. He arrived at the police station, saw the prisoner, and he said, "As far as I could judge, I found him quite of sound mind, able to answer any ordinary question. He said he found out that I was a doctor and hoped I should not think that he was insane. That this morning he had committed 2 murders and that he could die for. He said he had been deceived by 2 women in the past, which, as mentioned earlier on, and that he did not intend to do so in a third, i.e. Annie. He said he had threatened the woman sometime previously and she had asked him, as mentioned, to kill the child, blah, 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 mercy. He said, the doctor said he seemed quite sober, and he had been drinking some days previously. What else have we got? Oh, yeah, as mentioned. So in the cell at Marlborough Street Police Court, as he was awaiting his trial, as is his right, he was given a small meal, as mentioned. So it was meat, potatoes and bread. When he was being driven to the police, to Holloway Prison, which is where he stayed. Holloway Prison, in his last kind of century, was a women's prison, but actually back in the late 1800s it's a men's and women's prison. He remarked to Sergeant Vine, "I should be hanged and it should be a good job, as then I would be out of the way." He expressed a lot of kind of depressive thoughts around that point. As mentioned, okay, about the police meal, the policeman who was watching him at the time said he was the one who said he ate his meal with great lividity, as in, you know, really enjoying it and ripping apart the meat and things like that. But all the time his hands were still stained with the blood of Annie and Annie's child. What else we got? Yeah, he said the police inspector offered him a towel and some soap so he could wash his hands. But Joseph said, "I won't wash them. These were the hands that did it." Again, they said that he was perfectly sober around the time that he did it, but his hands were a mass of blood. As mentioned, even though she'd had her throat slit and her windpipe obviously severed and, you know, things like that, you know, quite horrific, the injuries to Annie, she survived until Monday the 24th of January. Oh, no, sorry, the murder happened on the 24th. Murder happened on the 20th. She technically survived until the 24th at 1 a.m. So she survived 3 days. She was taken to St. George's Hospital, which at that point was on the corner of Hyde Park Corner. A statement said she still lingers on, but not the slightest hopes are entertained for her recovery. The police said the surgeon at the time said she had a severe cut across her throat, which was really deep, and said that she never spoke a word. She was unable to, but that again the same with her child. The wound extended back round to her spine. I briefly mentioned about this, but Joseph's injury. So another doctor who was a fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons, one of the physicians who came to kind of look at Joseph to try and work out whether he was insane or not. This was done at Holloway Prison. Examined Joseph to ascertain his mind. He said, "I examined his head. I found a scar upon the upper part of his right frontal region, about an inch and a quarter in length. There was a considerable irregularity of the bone in that situation, so much so that I thought it possible that the bone had been fractured. There was a distinct tenderness on percussion, i.e. when he touched it, it was soft, and none of the other parts of the head. So it was just where he had landed, his skull was still soft. He said that he frequently had very severe pains in that part, that about 17 years ago he had been thrown over the head of a horse, pitching on its head, and that he was stunned for about half a day, that he remained in bed for two to 3 weeks, and that after that point he had done no work for 67 weeks. That's just over a year. He said his head had been cut and it bled very much around that time. So that's when he was 17 years old, around the time that he lost contact with his parents. So clearly there was something going on, hence... He also has that kind of paralysis down the right-hand side of his body, right-hand side of his face as well. He had a slight weakness in his right limbs. From those appearances, the doctor said, "I think it possible that there may have been some injury to the brain. I could get no history from him as of having any illness or any infection of the brain." But at that point, the doctor said, "Look, there's no evidence of him being of sound mind. He is an extremely weak-minded man, so weak-minded as to border upon imbecility." So they're saying that he is of low intellect, but he's not. He's not insane, therefore he's fit to stand trial. What else we got? Again, another doctor came in and said that he was not an imbecile. He was an imbecile. They love using that word. Then I'm going to sneeze at some point. oh, dear God. What else we got? When they spoke to him, obviously, with all of his talk about him being in love with Annie and that him and Annie being in a relationship and them having a quarrel and all these different things that were clearly bullshit, when the doctor spoke to him, they got the impression that he truly believed it, or that when he was expressing this, that he was telling the truth. He truly believed that he was telling the truth. But that these acts of violence frequently sprung from delusions. What else we got? Although, interestingly, at the time, the doctor said the paralysis I found was a slight paralysis to the right-hand side of the face, the cheek and the tongue, and that it is not connected with insanity. Thousands of people are paralysed for life who are not insane, which is true. So everything that they basically looked at here basically said, you know, yes, he's got a disability, but no, he's not insane. Hence, he was able to be tried and convicted. There was a small inquest held into the death of Henry Sutton, who was roughly around 18 months old at the time. And Annie died the day before the inquest. What else? So, as mentioned, he was sent to Holloway Prison. They said that while he was there, he behaved well and he was quiet. Again, they said he was a man of weak intellect and showed no signs of actual insanity. What else have we got? Tried at the Old Bailey on the 28th of April, 1887. What else have we got? The defence claimed that though he was not responsible for his actions owing to the injury to the skull, but the prosecution said no, he was guilty of this. He was found guilty, but the jury recommended mercy upon him owing to his weak state of mind. Mr. Justice Hawkins passed a sentence of death instead, and there was no leniency. Therefore, he was executed. The execution took place at Newgate Prison on Monday, the 21st of March, 1887, at just after 8 a.m. By this point, it was a private execution, so gone were the days where it would be a public execution and people would be outside going, rah, rah, rah. Instead, it was done indoors. There was a large crowd at assemble, but all they could actually see was the hoisting of a black flag outside Newgate Prison to indicate that someone had been executed. Joseph was visited in Holloway Prison and Newgate Prison by the chaplain, who described Joseph King as the most ignorant man I have ever come into contact with. Joseph's only visitor whilst he was at Newgate just before his execution was his brother, who came from Bury St Edmunds, but he had no other visitors. The executioner at that point was Berry. What else have we got about that? All his last real words were, during the pinioning process, King said, "There's no occasion to strap me so tight." Afterwards, he very briefly expressed regret at having killed the poor woman and her child, saying he was aggravated by jealousy. He then became faint and had to be supported on the scaffold. He died instantly, having been hung. And as was required, there was a short inquest into his death afterwards, which was deemed lawful. So there we go. There's all the extra details. Just think, all the people who don't like waffle, who don't like the bit where I talk about cake and stuff like that, have missed all that. They missed all the other interesting stuff. Sodom. Slurp of tea. Well, slurp of coffee. Oh, from a Murder Mile mug. All coffee and tea tastes better from a Murder Mile mug. Fact. Right, let's do the quiz questions. Okay, question number one. What did Joseph do as a job? He was a labourer and bricklayer. He actually helped... I may have edited this out of the episode. I think I said a note to myself that I'd edit it out anyway because it wasn't important. But there's a building called 10 South Audley Street... which is about two streets south of where he lived. And apparently that's where he was working at that time. So that building that's still there today was worked on by Joseph King. Question two. What was the last two things that Annie purchased on Duke Street? It was a loaf of bread and a jug of milk. Duke Street is this going to be a question next? It is, so I'm going to shut my gob. Question three. What was the name of Joseph's ex-wife? It was a trick question because he was unmarried, but he did have two prior relationships. Question four. What is currently underneath Brown Hart Gardens? It is an electricity substation. Question five. Which mass murder is nearest to Brown Hart Gardens? So at the Europa Hotel, it was the attack on the flight crew of LL-016. Some of the original buildings that these lodgers stayed in, because there was a selection of them all around Brown Hart Gardens, they were demolished in a year that I'm about to mention. To make way for things like the northern side of Grosvenor Square, which includes George Yard and the Europa Hotel, where the murder of the flight crew took place. Question six. What did Richard Bartholomew do as a job? Like many people in that house, he was a servant. He was known as an out-of-place servant, which meant he didn't have one specific job. He was kind of called to different places as and when. Question 7. What type of hat did Joseph wear? It was called a wide awake, which is a wide-brimmed felt hat. Question 8. What nickname did Joseph give his roommate Richard? He called him Daddy. Question 9. On what street did the public bathhouse that Annie used went to? Hang on, that's not even. On what street was the public bathhouse that Annie went to? Hard question. That's on Davies Street, which is about two streets away. Interestingly, this bathhouse was right next to Claridge's, so the very posh five-star hotel. And I think that's interesting because what it really does is it shows you that even in a really posh neighbourhood like Mayfair, in the late Victorian era, there were still many people in posh areas who didn't have indoor baths, so they still had to use the bathhouse, and it was still quite a poor area, so a lot of people, you know, going to the bathhouse was their only time that they could ever have a bath or get themselves clean. And question 10, what year was 19 bath oh I've gone tired question 10, what year was 19 Hart Street and most of Hart Street demolished? That was 1888. And that was 1 year after the murder. Ooh, excitement. There we go. So, that's all done. So I hope you enjoyed that. That's going to be an utter bugger for me to edit because that was a really long edit. That was a really long record. That almost killed me. Oh, I wish I had some cake. Anyway, that's me done. Hope you enjoyed that. Have yourself a good week. Stay safe. Be good. Lots of love. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.